Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Today is the day, and today is that day when Nicole Phillips brings us a little kindness story. So, Nicole, welcome back.
Hi, Carmen. Welcome back to you, too. Did you have a great vacation?
I had a great vacation. What is the feast of kindness you have for us today?
Well, I really think that kindness in baby steps can make a big impact. My friend Anne goes to the same Speedway gas station every single day to get her iced tea. And instead of just going in, paying, and, you know, saying hello and leaving and being pleasant, she engages the women who work there. And so now she knows how many grandkids they have, and she knows they know her husband, and they ask about different things. And it really becomes more flavorful in our lives when we do that. So, you know, if you're a person who knows the name of your mailman, or if you say hi to your mailman, maybe the next time you ask your mail carrier, what's your name? And if you already do that, maybe you offer a bottle of water. And if you already do that, maybe you say, hey, you know, how was your weekend? So it's this incremental thing. So we don't jump in if we're kind of nervous about speaking with people. We don't have to jump in and become a best friend. But little by little by little, it really adds a lot of spice to life when we can show people kindness by paying attention to them.
Yeah, that just makes some simple observations about, you know, the way people are, you know, wearing what's going on the inside on the outside. I think that those are often simple ways for us to acknowledge the humanity of one another, start a conversation, and as you say, just demonstrate kindness in such mm-hmm. simple ways.
Yep. Baby steps. It's all important, and it all adds up.
All right. And if you just think for a moment about baby steps and what babies look like when they're taking their first steps, you are going to smile, because that is just funny in and of itself. So there you go. All right. So it is Nicole Phillips. You can find her at NicoleJPhillips.com. Get another dose of kindness. Be brave. Be kind. Be you. We'll be right back. So my next guest is Timothy McMahon King. He is the author of a book called Addiction Nation. Opioids claim the lives of 115 people per day. One of them could have been me. Tim King, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, let's just start with this. When you make a statement like that, opioids claim the lives of 115 people per day, first of all, we should pause on that statistic and recognize the preciousness of each and every one of those lives and the impact on those families and communities. But then you say one of them could have been me. So tell us your story.
Well, thanks for letting me share this story, because this is something that I truly believe we need more spaces to share these kind of difficult stories so that people can come forward and do the same. And one of the wild things with that statistic is, even since the book has come out, since we first designed the cover, that number is now up to 130 per day. Mm. And my story started in the hospital. I had a procedure go wrong. I was put on heavy doses of narcotics. I was in the ICU. The doctors thought that I might go. My family came in to say prayers by my bedside. And I came through. And I knew while I was in the hospital for months, that I was on the precipice, that it could be life or death. But I didn't realize when I went home that I was facing a new potentially fatal complication, and that's opioid addiction. And there's a greater awareness today than when that happened to me about 10 years ago of the potential for addiction with opioids. But at the same time, one of the things is, while opioids are one of the most obvious forms of addiction in our country today, with people overdosing every day, I really believe that the opioid crisis is about more than just opioids, that we in our country are in a broader addiction crisis. And in fact, overdoses have been doubling every 9 years since 1979.
So, Tim, I want to be sure that people understand what we're talking about, because there's at least some stigma or imagining related to this that's like, you know, opioids are just heroin, and we're just talking about addicts shooting up in really nasty houses in parts of town we wouldn't go to if we could avoid it. When you talk about you and you talk about becoming addicted to opioids because of a medical procedure that that was dangerously unsuccessful, You open our eyes to the reality that opioids is an issue that people deal with in America from literally every sector of our culture and society. Talk about that.
So, yeah, with opioids especially, they can be a powerful medicine. And for some people, and for me for a little while, it was something that helped me recover because my body was in so much stress, I was in so much pain that I needed that relief for a while. And that's true of some people today. And it's important that we don't just demonize the substance, but we understand everything that's related to addiction. And one of the first things that I learned that was just stuck in my head was this idea that anyone who gets addicted is just a bad person, right? And one of the things I was so grateful for is when my doctor finally sat me down and he had seen that I was taking more pain medicine instead of less, and that I was coming in more and more often for refills, he said, "Tim, I know you're addicted, but you didn't do anything wrong." And I think that's so important for listeners out there to hear, that when it comes to addiction, for a long time, we kind of section people off as if they were like this unique group of immoral people somehow. When in fact, we understand now that addiction does happen to us all. And in one level, it's important for doctors to be able to distinguish an addiction that needs to be treated by professionals. But another more spiritual level, we all are addicted. And addiction might be one of the best ways that we can understand sin today. When Paul says, "I do the things that I don't want to do, and I don't do the very things that I want to do," that is a description of what it feels like to be addicted. And so my hope is that more people are able to talk about it in that kind of way, where it's not something that we feel shame about that, right? When Paul is talking about sin in that way, that's just not to make everybody to feel bad, but to say to his readers and to say, you know, that we can say to our brothers and sisters today, "Hey, you're not alone. When you have those moments when you feel like you can't do the thing that you are here to do, that you want to do, and you're struggling, that's not a unique category of person. That's the very description of what it means to be human struggling with sin."
So here is a quote from Addiction Nation, "What the opioid crisis reveals about us." It's by Timothy McMahon King. And here's a quote. "The question for each of us is not whether we are addicted, but how we are addicted and to what. Denial of the existence of addiction in your life is not a mark of moral accomplishment, but a sign of blindness." The pervasiveness of addiction is one of the things that you deal with in the book, but you deal with the reality of our addiction nation from a number of angles: the injustice of the war on drugs, the crisis of meaning, institutional evil, technology. When we come back from the break, Tim, I'm hoping that maybe we can delve into one of those. Let's take the crisis of meaning component of the book and let's grapple with that. Because I think that for folks listening right now, that, you know, that may be the touch point where we can dig in a little, maybe more easily than we can on some of the things that are going to require culture-wide change. But I think we can all peel back this concern about a crisis of meaning in our own lives, in our families, in the next generation, in the culture around us. So I'm going to continue my conversation here in just a moment. Timothy King is my guest. The book is Addiction Nation, What the Opioid Crisis Reveals About Us. We'll be right back. Continuing my conversation with Timothy King about Addiction Nation, what the opioid crisis reveals about us. And when he's talking about us, he's talking about us as a people, not just individually, but as a culture. And so, Tim, let's talk about this crisis of meaning. Help us grapple with the addiction crisis from that particular angle.
So one thing to understand with addiction is normally how I had approached it before is to think of it, addiction is like the pursuit, the relentless pursuit of something bad or just a physical pleasure, where at its heart, addiction is actually the pursuit of something good. And I want people to hang with me on that for a second. Addiction at its heart is the pursuit of something good that goes wrong. Because all of us are searching for some sort of connection, some sort of transcendence, or in my case, it was a relief from pain. And what happened is in the early stages of addiction, my use of opioids provided that. And they provided not just a relief from physical pain, but also a temporary sense of safety, even when I wasn't safe in the hospital, or connection when I was home and actually growing increasingly isolated from people. And one thing to understand with opioids is they are so powerful, not because they're so foreign to our brains, but because they actually mimic what happens in our brains naturally. So endorphins, the molecules of emotion, they're what can bind parents to children or partners to each other. That chemical endorphin is actually named after morphine. It's the two words endogenous, meaning occurring within, and morphine. And so those endorphins that connect us to each other are closely mimicked by opioids like morphine. So when you look around at our country today, and you look at how people are so disconnected from each other and in desiring of community, it's not a surprise that so many people have turned to opioids that mimic that sense of connection, that mimic that sense of love. And so I think all of us are carrying around some sort of pain. We're all carrying around some sort of desire for something more. And a lot of your listeners might be familiar with that idea that all of us have some sort of God-shaped hole in our lives that we are seeking to fill. And that's a good desire. But what happens with addiction is we fill it with something finite instead of something infinite. And that finite thing, no matter how much of it we get, and if we keep wanting more and more, we're never going to add up to that infinite.
You make a lot of sense. I hope people are telling you that. And I hope that you are, I hope you're hearing from a lot of people that the way you are articulating this is helping people understand maybe what they're experiencing in their own lives, if they're at the point where they're recognizing that they are addicted to something, as you note, actually, we all are. We just each have an addiction that may be different. I take note of this quote. This is really, I think, what captures the heart maybe of my concern, and that what we're talking about here is a real devolution of our culture. And it's not just opioid addictions, although that's the presenting concern here in this conversation. When you say this, when hundreds of thousands of individuals decide to give up on life at the same time, and here you're pointing to rising drug overdoses, alcohol-related death, suicides, which are now epidemic in our culture. So when hundreds of thousands of individuals decide to give up on life at the same time and in the same ways, we need to reflect on a broader societal failure to create a context of meaning and connection that makes life worth living. What are you talking about?
So we hear that word a lot, that there's an epidemic. And when you look at any epidemic, you can look at what has been introduced into the environment that's new. So in that case, opioids. But really, the other thing that you need to look at with an epidemic is what has changed in the host. What has changed in us? What has changed in society? And really right now, I think opioids are one substance that we need to worry about. But if it isn't opioids, it could be something else. If what is really at heart of this is something that has changed within all of us. And I think that what we're seeing right now is a deep desire for something more. We are looking for a deep desire for a life that gives us deeper meaning. And this was one of the oddest things when I was in my doctor's office. He was a pancreatic specialist, and I was not expecting him to ask me the question, Tim, what does a full life look like for you? And what he was getting at is that overcoming an addiction is not so much about saying no to a substance or to a behavior. Overcoming an addiction is ultimately about saying yes to something greater, saying yes to something that's worth living for. And one of the stories Jesus tells is he talks about the casting out a demon from a home, and then the home being left empty, and then seven coming back in even worse than before. And that's something where even if someone is able to give up the substance or give up the behavior for a little while, if there isn't something greater, if there isn't hope that that person can latch on to, then I think you're going to end up in a place even worse than before. And that's why I think with this crisis, we need to start with that compassionate understanding of where is this desire coming from? Where is this desire to heal pain or to transcend a mundane life coming from? And if we're able to answer that, if we're able to provide a greater yes, the no will come in time.
My conversation partner is Timothy McMahon King. The book is Addiction Nation, What the Opioid Crisis Reveals About Us. Timothy has a Facebook page. You can follow him there. I know that there are many of you who are seeking information about how to track him down. So on Facebook, at Timothy McMahon King, McMahon is M-C-M-A-H-A-N. He is on Twitter. I just found him. Give us your Twitter handle.
It's at T-M King.
All right, so it's at TM King on Twitter. One of our listeners has commented here on our text line, Tim, that this is a beautiful conversation. I hope that's what people are hearing in not only what you're saying, but the way in which you're saying it. This is very invitational. You don't seem angry, and you don't seem resentful. You seem very hopeful and committed to helping others understand not only the journey that you have been on and your family has been on, because nobody journeys this alone, but the journey that really as a culture we are all on together. We're just not all actively engaged in our sort of collective recovery and confronting the addiction that's now just rampant in our culture. And so as we conclude our conversation today, I'm wondering, maybe just talk about why you moved home to New Hampshire after your recovery. Why'd you go home?
So that actually came a few years later. I had been in Washington, D.C. and working there, and I hit a point in my life where I realized that some of the most valuable things that I could find in life were not in Washington, D.C., not in the halls of power, not with what was happening there, but with connection to family, friends. And my family's had a farm there for hundreds of years. And that sort of deep connection was what mattered. And at the same time, as I moved home, I was able to see what was happening in the community around me. And I wanted to be involved in that. And I hadn't told my story publicly before I came back to New Hampshire, when I was able to look around and think of this not as I did something so great, or I was so strong, or I had this great willpower, but realizing that I had gifts, I had grace in my life from other people. And if more people had that, then we wouldn't have the kind of crisis we have today. And one of the reasons why I think it's so important for us to change how we talk about addiction and how we think about it was this great study that I found by two researchers, Leek and King. And they went to three different alcohol recovery centers, and they studied everybody who was being treated there. And at the end of their study, they went to the staff and to the counselors, and they provided them a list. And they said, here are the people we believe are most likely to recover. And sure enough, the researchers come back a year later and they were spot on. And so everyone wanted to know, what did you guys figure out that was so powerful to predict exactly who would recover and who wouldn't? And the answer was nothing. They had randomly assigned everybody to that list. The only thing that had changed was the expectations of the staff and the counselors. And I believe that while each of us has a role to play in overcoming this addiction crisis, each of us, whether we know it or not right now, has someone in our lives who needs compassion, who needs grace, who needs understanding. They don't need blame. They need someone who understands that each of us is looking for some sort of relief of pain, some sort of connection, some sort of transcendence to something higher and greater than ourselves. And people in my life were that grace to me. And I know that each of us can be that kind of grace to another person.
I just want to say thank you. Timothy King, thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you for the book, Addiction Nation, What the Opioid Crisis Reveals About Us. And thank you for the manner in which you are speaking grace into this issue.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back. Okay, when we come back from the news, we're going to jump right into a conversation with Steve Graves on his excellent book, 41 Deposit, Crucial Conversations for Fathers and Sons. We have copies available. You can text me at 877-933-2484 or email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Joining me today is Stephen Graves. I'm going to go ahead and give you the website because I want you to check it out, StephenRGraves.com. Steve is a strategist. He's a CEO advisor, and he's an author. At any given time, he might be working with an executive that's leading a large global organization or a young social entrepreneur just starting out. He's authored over a dozen books. He's worked with thousands of leaders, all aimed at helping people flourish in life and work. So what we're talking about today specifically is his new book called 41 Deposits. Steve Graves, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Hey, thanks so much, Carmen. Great to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you here. Let's just start with what is, or what are, maybe I should say, 41 Deposits, and what inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, thanks. So this is a little bit of a different kind of book for me. It's actually a book that captures the time that I spent with my son when he and I actually we'd get together over a bagel, over breakfast, and we would talk about kind of matters of life that I felt like was pretty crucial for him as he was going through his 3 years of high school. And the long and the short backstory is I did not really grow up with a dad actively involved in my life as in the home, but I did have a ton of father figures that shaped, steered and influenced my life. And so what I wanted to do is make sure that I had done everything I could do to really help intentionally shape my son. And so, you know, as you guys know, any parent knows, you know, most parents have great intentions. I mean, we really all aspire for our children to grow up well-adjusted and to be contributing adults when they get there. But sometimes, you know, we find ourselves getting lost in some role that kind of floats between, you know, maybe a concierge car service. You know, we're just shuttling people around from one thing to the next, you know, or some kind of fashion guide, making sure the kids have the right shoes or the right clothes or whatever. And, you know, and even though we want to provide them what I would call a greenhouse or a launching pad, you know, we kind of wake up and the time's over. And so I purposely wanted to make sure that my son and I had some times to discuss matters of things that I felt like were important. And so literally we set out, I made a list of about 50 topics. And as he entered high school, we would get together. It wasn't like a Bible study where we got together, you know, every week on the same day. And I was just trying to kind of check my way off through the topics. These were more things that I really wanted to make sure that I had made what I would call significant wisdom deposits into his mind and sound relational deposits into his heart. And I can tell you more about that later. So basically, these 41 deposits, as I came up nine short. He graduated before I got to all the 50, but that's okay. And so this is a book that captures those particular topics that he and I covered during those 3 years.
Okay, so first of all, I just love the idea behind this. I think that when we talk about legacy, we often talk about, you know, at the very end of life, let's be sure that we've imparted to the next generation what we think they should have or know. And what you are doing is you're actually ensuring that legacy on the front end by being sure that these wisdom deposits and these heart deposits are actually made, and how much fun it's going to be for you to watch those grow and to watch them produce good fruit. You're going to actually get to see the return on the investment that you've made through these deposits. And I think that for people who think in terms of and think in business terms, this is also just a wonderful. There's a wonderful mental hook here for men in particular. So just, you know, wander around in that a little bit. Invite dads who would be very intimidated by this idea. Invite them into sort of how you structure this conversation in the book, so that we can remove some of that layer of fear of doing this.
Yeah. Thanks for framing it like that. So, you know, a lot of times, I mean, some people are wired, their giftedness is they think list, they think topics, they think frameworks and structures. And if that's who you are, you know, you probably don't need the book as anything other than maybe idea bases and, you know, kind of jumping off from one topic to the next. Some people, however, really need more structure or more frameworks. And so what we did is we put together around these 41 deposits, we kind of broke them down into my core, my faith, my heart, my relationships, my work, and my future. And basically every one of them, I have kind of an opening story, and then I go through a few key insights, and then, you know, I just try to shape a prayer or two. And my whole goal, to be really frank with you, this is not a Bible study per se. It can function. Obviously it's built around scripture, mm-hmm. but, it's really, you know, it's more about the idea that I'm trying to create a situation that allows a context that allows a father and his son or a parent and their child to really create what I call legitimate, authentic knot tying between the heart of a parent and the heart of the child. I really believe, frankly, I mean, I'm not a prescriptive guy. I don't, my CEO advising is non-prescriptive. In other words, it's not like here's all the answers, no matter what your question is, here's all the answers. That's not really my model. And so in parenting, I'm not a prescriptive parent either. You know, I mean, only a naive parent who doesn't have children, or at the early days of having children really would be somebody who thinks, you know, if you just do these four things, it's going to all turn out perfectly. That's just not how life works. And so the big idea for parenting, in my opinion, is that the parent has to take the initiative to tie a knot between the heart, around the heart of the child and the heart of the parent. And then as life hits the child and as life hits the parent, that knot gets frayed, that knot gets loose, that knot actually might even unravel and get pretty gnarly. You know, like take puberty, take puberty, you know, take college.
I have
college.
A 13-year-old boy.
You got
so,
a girl.
Yeah, take
you got
puberty,
a girl.
Man. Yeah.
Take puberty, yeah. Take puberty. And so, you know, so you go through these seasons and cycles of life. And, you know, parenting is not just wrapping up a big knot when they're four and then hoping and holding on for the rest of their life. As life happens, it's crucial that we have a deep enough, legitimate enough relationship that as that knot kind of starts wobbling or starts fraying a little bit, we have the relationship good enough that we can re-enter and tie it up again. And you just do that the rest of your life with your children. Now, you know, we all know, I mean, any parent knows that you kind of shift from a control framework to more of a coaching framework to more of a cheerleading framework or championing framework, you know, and that's kind of the framework that sets you and your child. But so these 41 deposits they're simply topics that my son and I were able to have. Some topics we just jumped in, we knocked them out over one bagel. The next week or the next 2 weeks, we would go over another one. Some topics we stuck on them for maybe 2 months. because it was something we really needed to bore down under and really wrestle hard. And I had some issues in life that I wanted to share with him, and he did back to me, or things like that. So the big idea, I think, Carmen, that I'd love to at least present is that it is a framework. It is biblically based. And it is built around a methodical kind of a one to the next, to the next, to the next. But the whole idea is really trying to, it's trying to animate and release and heighten the concept that authentic friendship and relationship is at the core of all great parenting. I mean, you know, somebody else could write a book and they could come up with a different 41 for their child. And that's awesome. Yeah, that's fantastic. But the key is, you know, do you have a tight enough relationship that as life unravels itself, you can go back in and tie it back up again?
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, you and I are going to talk about some of the subjects that are in the book. And then I'd love to know, you know, how over time has this really affected your relationship with your son, Kyle? And we can go from there. So we are having a conversation today with Stephen Graves. The book is 41 Deposits. Crucial conversations for fathers and sons. We'll be right back. Returning to our conversation now with Stephen Graves about 41 Deposits, Crucial Conversations for Fathers and Sons. You can visit Steve online at StephenRGraves.com. Steve, when we left off, we said we were just touch on a few of the topics that are in the book. So just give people a little bit of a sense of some of the topics that are covered in here.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, again, these are just the ones that I created that I felt like was crucial for me and my son. So, you know, we talk about defining success, taking initiative, learning contentment, accepting myself, picking friends, working hard, handling money, thinking ahead, understanding valleys, living daily, getting married, you know, finishing well, having fun, practicing rest. I mean, just on and on. And good. And so, you know, we package them up in a way that they kind of coalesce around topics. But again, they're just real practical, you know, because I'm a real world guy. I'm a street back guy. I'm not a classroom or pulpit out guy. I'm kind of from the market or the street back. And so they're things that I wrestled with and still wrestle with. And so that's kind of the framework. Those are some of the topics.
Well, and one of the things I really appreciate about this is that it is a conversation. One of the things that this book actually teaches people how to do is how to talk to with your child as an emerging adult, like as they are not only coming to understand themselves and the world better, but you better. And there's this movement in the relationship between father and son that you can feel. You can actually feel the movement from, you know, how you might have these conversations with a young teenager versus how you might have these conversations with an older teenager. So talk with us a little bit about how your relationship with Kyle was affected by this exercise, not only of walking around, making these deposits, but also, you know, in the process of him growing up.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I completely agree with your insight, Carmen, on the way it unfolds with different people and as kids get older. It's really funny, as it might happen this morning, I actually went and had a meeting with somebody at the same bagel shop that Kyle and I had spent our 3 years with, you know, together. And it just kind of happened. And I was sitting there this morning thinking about those years. I mean, he's 26 now, and so he's years removed from high school. But I was sitting there this morning thinking about some of the meetings that we had and some of those breakfasts. And I can remember one vividly where we talked about a very hard topic. I mean, a very, very hard topic for, you know, for he and I both. And I remember as we were leaving, you know, I felt like we'd had a really good, honest conversation while we were sitting there over bagels. And I mean, you know, as a dad, you know, you're always happy if you can have a conversation with any of your children, especially when they're in high school. And so we were walking to the car, and I remember he said, "Hey, I need to tell you something." And I said, "Well, tell me." And I remember he told me about a personal failure that he had had, and he started crying. and we hugged and we cried together. And it was just kind of like, wow. I mean, you know, and that's, you know, it's not like he and I did that every week. We, you know, that's just not who we are as people. We hug a lot. We tell each other we love each other. But this particular morning, there was a very raw, open, honest moment. And, you know, and I really believe what's happened is my son and I have developed a closeness. And I've got two daughters too, that we're very close. I mean, our whole families are very close. We run hard. We play hard. I mean, we love life together. That's just who we are. But my son and I have developed, because of this opportunity, the chemistry between he and I, and we're very different. You know, my wife and I are very different. He's wired way more like my wife than I am, or that he is to me, you know. But what this has done, this has created kind of a shorthand connection, and a kind of a really interesting intimacy that he and I have as a father son. That's incredible. I mean, it's awesome. And, you know, I'm still learning trying to learn how to be a parent of an adult child. You know, it's really easy on paper, but as your kids get older, you got to kind of figure out how that looks, because literally your entire muscle memory group of being a parent looked like a parent of control or a parent who's coaching. And now you got to be a parent who's more championing and cheerleading. And, you know, I mean, your 26 and 28 and 30 year old children, they don't want you controlling. I mean, good night. Mm-hmm. And they actually don't want you coaching all the time. You know, I mean, there was a season for that, but not now. And so, to your question, Carmen, he and I have we both love to fish. We go stand out in the river all the time together, and he'll be a distance from me and we'll see each other. And then we'll meet back on the bank and chat for a while. And, you know, I mean, we're close. There's a closeness and an understanding and acceptance and a trust between he and I that is specifically directly tied to those days that we would get together for 30 minutes or an hour over a bagel, you know, during, like, once a week or every other week during his 3 years through high school.
Mm. Okay, friends, the book is 41 Deposits, Crucial Conversations for Fathers and Sons. If you're thinking to yourself, I'd really like a copy, you are welcome to email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com, and we'll enter you into the drawing to receive one of the copies that we have here in the studio. Again, it's 41 Deposits, Crucial Conversations for Fathers and Sons. The author is Steve Graves. You can check out other things that Steve is doing online at StephenRGraves.com. Steve, I know that there are people listening right now who are thinking to themselves, what about girls? What about girls? And so I want to say to them, let me just remind folks about the Disciple Making Parents Donut Date Journal. That is actually a very, very similar resource, about 70 questions to connect you to your child's heart. That's really, really good for dads and girls. And so that's by Chap Bettis. So if you're the dad of a girl and you're thinking, I need a resource, you can certainly use the one, use the one that Steve developed with his son Kyle, 41 Deposits. But if you're looking for one that's a little more girly, there's actually one called the Donut Date Journal that I also just can personally highly recommend. Steve, thank you so very much. I would encourage you to maybe find a way to let all of us know, as these deposits bear returns, share with people what those are. Like, and if that's somehow allowing Kyle to, you know, share, hey, my dad deposited these things in this way when I was a teenager, and this is the kind of fruit it's now bearing and a harvest of righteousness in my own life. That's the kind of, I just think, positive testimony that we need more of in the world today.
Great. Hey, thanks so much for letting me join you today.
Oh, thank you so much. Again, that's Steve Graves. You can check it out at StephenRGraves.com. The book is 41 Deposits, Crucial Conversations for Fathers and Sons. If you're interested in entering the drawing for a copy, you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com.
Pray Together Sunday is a simple opportunity for your church to join with congregations across America and ask God for the same thing, that we would be people who love God and love others well. Talk to your church about participating during its July 7th worship service. Register at nae.net/praytogether. The National Association of Evangelicals is where we use influence for good.
All right, so we don't have much time here at the end of this hour, but I want to celebrate with you the conversations that we have had the opportunity to have today. Be kind today. Find opportunities, as Nicole Phillips reminded us, to walk our faith out, even in baby steps. Be kind to the people who you encounter today. Timothy McMahon King reminds us we live in an addiction nation. Each one of us suffers with addiction. And we need to recognize that, and we need to confront it, and we need to recognize that we're trying to fill that need within us with something other than God. And then ultimately, what are the deposits we're making in the next generation? So just thankful for Steve Graves and 41 Deposits. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.